Hello and welcome to this episode of The Feast is Life, a podcast for fanables ready for deep dives into unexplored aspects of the show and extraordinary ingredients that create the delicious recipe of our fandom. On today's episode, DB and Dream are diving headfirst into Botticelli's Primavera, a painting from the Italian Renaissance that plays a significant role in Hannibal's season 3. We'll be discussing Botticelli, the mythological and religious symbolism of the figures in the painting, and how it all ties into the Hannibal narrative. So stay tuned, or we will make you an acupuncture appointment with the scary bee lady who loves venom.
This episode of The Feast is Life was brought to you by Nobody Yet. Artists and merch makers are fic writers who do commissions. Let us know if you're interested in an ad spot. It's cheap. We're talking like, I don't know, like $5 cheap. We will talk you up, or you can write your own ad that we read for you, or even record your own. Email the show at dbmars33@gmail.com. This show is also brought to you by the patrons who have subscribed to our Patreon. For $5 a month, you get access to bonus content, and we have big plans for incredible extras that are for patrons only. Currently, we send our patrons personalized Hannibal-themed birthday cards, give them access to fancy PDFs and Word documents of DB's fix, and provide our own personal show notes. But there's much more in store. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/thefeastislife. And we have some big news. We have our very first patron. We want to say a huge, huge thank you to Blamey Blit for joining the Famished Fanimals. We're so grateful for your support, and you will live forever in our hearts as our first ever patron of the show. I'm folding you up a human corpse Valentine right now in my mind.
Blamey, seriously, like, we adore you. Thank you so much. It's hard to be the first patron, and you jumped right in there and sent us a delightful message as well. So that was amazing. And we just want to say a huge, huge thanks to you. Okay, so we're getting into the meat of the show now, and we did want to do a little trigger warning. This analysis is going to talk about like classical mythology, which we all know is like pretty fucking fucked up as shit. So there are going to be mentions of sexual assault and abuse. So just please use discretion, as it's not for everybody. So we're going to kick it off with Dream telling us first just about Botticelli as a human being and what his whole deal was back in the day. So whenever you're ready, I'd love to hear more about this guy.
All right. Well, he's definitely an interesting fellow. I had a lot of fun researching him. I'm just going to preface this by saying I'm probably going to mispronounce a lot of things because I didn't really do my homework on how things are pronounced. So here you go. So it should be funny. So first of all, what I want to say is a lot of what we know about Botticelli doesn't come directly from him or even his contemporaries. It comes from people after him who kind of were looking back. So not everything is going to be 100% factually accurate. There's still a lot of unknowns about him and his life. There's a lot of evidence for the things that I'm going to be talking about. So Sandro Botticelli was born in Florence, Italy in 1445. He was born as Alessandro di Marino Giovanni Filippetti.
can I do one? I want to do it, and I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it in like a Mario, okay, a Mario we'll Brothers.
You're gonna do that.
Alessandro di Mariano Giovanni Filippetti.
Okay, that's probably 10 times closer to what I said.
Just have to sell it. You have to sell it with just imagine yourself as a short plumber with a mustache, and it flows from somewhere deeply authentic, obviously.
So basically, how did he become Sandro Botticelli with that name, that long mouthful of a name? So he needed a nickname. So Botticelli is actually a nickname that his brother had prior to him. And there's some thought that the reason why he has this nickname is because he was a similar body shape to his brother, and he kind of stole it and started going by that as well. So what it means is little barrel. So I kind of like to imagine him as like a stocky dude with like a beer belly.
His nickname was Pony Keg.
Kind of cute, actually. Like, it's kind of adorable. And I like that, you know, it's something not serious, but now that's what he's known as. So he was born, lived, and died in Florence. He really didn't move very far away from his birthplace at all, like in the same region of the city. So he's a Florence OG. Like he lived and died there. So Botticelli entered the workshop of Frau Filippo Lippi, who was born in 1406 and lived till 1459, towards the end of the 1450s. So Botticelli would have been around 13 or so. Apprentices at that time started young. So Lippi had the favor of the politically and economically powerful Medici family, and so eventually did Botticelli. So he knew somebody in a high place, and then he ended up becoming in a high place as well. So he was among the artists at the Florentine court of Lorenzo the Magnificent de' Medici, along with Leonardo da Vinci. So it seems like that, just based on my research, that they were friends. They lived at the same time, but they did have some artistic differences that are actually really hilarious. So Botticelli once claimed that he did not like landscape painting because he, quote, said, "By throwing a sponge soaked with different colors at a wall, one can make a spot in which a beautiful landscape can be seen." Leonardo responded angrily in his notebook, "Although that stain may suggest ideas, it will not teach you to complete any art. And the above-mentioned painter, Botticelli, paints very bad landscapes."
Ooh,
So I love
girl.
ancient tea, don't you? It's still hot after all these years.
He was throwing some shade for sure. I think actually we should do as part something for our patrons. We will test the Botticelli landscape theory by throwing sponges with paint at walls and seeing once and for all like who was correct in history.
I think this is a really good idea. It'll be a really interesting like Rorschach test. We should do
Yeah.
it and then like send each other pictures and then we can kind
Ooh.
of say what we see.
There we go. There we go. And
Like,
so
what
that
about
brings
the
it back to
personality
Hannibal. Yeah,
test?
because we're trying to find a way that psychology and psychiatry fits into this as well.
Exactly. Okay. So see, it all ties in together. It all
Yes,
ties in.
it always does.
All right. So something interesting about Botticelli is all of the women in his paintings have the same face. Especially his Venuses. So there's rumors that this lady named Simonetta Vespucci, who was the wife of Marco Vespucci, there's rumors that she was Botticelli's model and muse. So the Vespucci's were a wealthy and prominent family. There's this gentleman named Amerigo Vespucci. He's the explorer and voyager after whom the Americas were named. So when Botticelli started painting, Simonetta had been dead by that time. So there's kind of like, we're unsure if that's actually like that was his muse or not. But at that time, all the men in Florence were supposedly in love with her. And she was just this great beauty, kind of like a Helen of Troy kind of thing. So I'm thinking maybe he held a torch for her, like even after she died. Maybe he caught sight of her and her beauty just astounded him so much that every time he drew a woman, he had to draw her, which is actually kind of really romantic when you think about it. So I kind of like that a little bit better than any of the other theories because it's kind of cute. Botticelli asked to be buried at the foot of her tomb, and he actually is. So
Damn.
that kind of gives credence to the Simonetta thing being true because he's literally buried at her feet. But I did a little bit further research, and the church that they're both buried in is the church that Botticelli was baptized in. So there's that too. And this was a really religious gentleman, especially towards his later years, which I'll talk about shortly.
I thought you were going to say that you did some research and you found out that there were like 18 other guys buried at her feet, just like in a pile.
Not the mass burial. Okay. And it's funny because when I was thinking about that, like, why does it low key sound like something Hannibal would do if Will died before him? Like, literally, this is something he would do. It's like romantic, but kind of creepy. And I'm thinking if you're listening to this podcast, it goes without saying that you live for the romantic and the creepy. So there we are.
I often think of them when I see that picture of the excavated tomb with the two skeletons holding hands.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anything morbid and cute, anything morbid and romantic, we
Yes.
associate with them.
That's the flavor.
So Botticelli was a lifelong bachelor. There's literally no evidence at all. Number one, he was never married. Number two, there's no writings or anything like that that he had any significant romantic relationships at all in his whole life. So he hated marriage, hated it. Someone had once asked him why he wasn't married, and Botticelli replied that he had recently dreamed that he was married. He woke up feeling a deep sense of grief, and he walked around the city to stop himself from falling asleep again and resuming the dream. So that doesn't sound like a dream to me, bud. That sounds like a nightmare. So definitely marriage phobic. There was also an accusation from the Florentine archives from 1502 that Botticelli kept a boy. So you know where I'm going with this. At that time, accusations of someone being a homosexual or being involved in homosexual relationships was kind of petty slander, and that sort of thing should kind of be taken with a grain of salt, of course. But if we take a look at the painting of Saint Sebastian, tell me the man wasn't at least a little bit fruity. So DB has referenced the painting of Saint Sebastian in her fix. So could you share a little bit about that, DB?
Oh yeah, definitely. So Saint Sebastian is the, I don't know what he's the patron saint of besides just like BDSM, to be honest, because part of his martyrdom involved, which actually he did not die from this, but part of it involved being tied to like a post or a tree, and then guys like shot arrows at him. And so he's often depicted as tied up with arrows sticking out of him with pretty much a loincloth on, if that. And it just seems like, you know, this, we're not talking like arrows like you know, that the end of the Fellowship of the Ring when Boromir gets shot up by those like huge ass arrows that just completely destroy him. They're not Uruk-hai arrows, right? They're like little itty bitty, like dainty little arrows, and he's just like, ow, oh, it really hurts. So that he doesn't look all that bothered by it. And a lot of his depictions are like just really erotic looking. So a couple of times I did reference this in fic, and I am going to indulge myself in talking about them now because I can, and I can always cut it out later. So in a chapter of one of my ongoing fics, Daylight Incorporated, Hannibal is a vampire, Will is a vampire hunter, and they end up at a pretty much a vampire human trafficking auction where vampires are trading harem participants slash blood slaves, and they have to go undercover, and Will is pretending to be Hannibal's little bitch, I guess, and they have to have fake names. And of course, Hannibal gets Boris Yakov, and he names Will Sebastian. And Will thinks to himself, it's because of all of those horny pictures of Saint Sebastian that Hannibal loves so much. But I delved a lot deeper into it in Bram Stoker's Hannibal, which is a much more serious fic. I'm reading this out of my brand new, just arrived today, hard copy of Act Four, which looks super cool, by the way. This happens in the Dracula novel, and it happens in Bram Stoker's Hannibal, where Dracula slash Hannibal tricks our vampire slayers, Van Helsing slash Van Crawford and the crew, by making them think he's going to ship himself in a box of earth to a port in Varna, which is in Bulgaria. But he does a little like switch, and he actually has himself sent to Galați, which is in Romania. It's a different town. And so when they're sitting around in Varna waiting for him to show up so that they can hop on board that boat, open up the crate of earth, and give him the old stake through the heart, choppity chop, head removal. He actually shows up in Galat instead. And so when I was writing that section, I wanted to bring us back into Hannibal's point of view because we'd been with Will for so long. So I imagined him getting off the boat in Galat and, you know, having a little shore leave slash murder trip. So he shows up in Galat, and I did some research, and I found out that there was a famous Ukrainian folk hero named Mazepa, who was a Cossack who was buried in Galat, or was kind of, and kind of still is. And so I was thinking about the war in Ukraine and how I also found some articles in this deep dive about Mazepa becoming like coming back into public consciousness in Ukraine because he defied the Russians, and so they were sort of embracing him again as a national hero. And I just thought it was really interesting that he happens to be buried in this town where Hannibal shows up. And so I started reading about that. And this is giving you a backstage view into my mind and how it works when I'm writing this stuff. So then I go from Mazeppa and I'm reading about him, and I find Lord Byron actually wrote a poem about him. And that brings me back to Anthony Dimond, who in Bram Stoker's Hannibal is a Byron ripoff who thinks he's just as cool and romantic, and but is of course kind of a douche. Hannibal shows up here in Galat, and he finds the cathedral, which is actually no longer there, where Mazeppa's body was allegedly entombed at one point. And this all comes back to Saint Sebastian, I promise. So I'm just gonna read you a section of it. And it's not smutty, sorry. So this is in Hannibal's perspective. He's currently in bat form, of course, flying through the sky. As I wheel through the darkened sky along the riverbank, I find the crumbling cathedral, St. George's, where Mazeppa's bones are entombed, resting at last after several grave robberies and other desecrations. He'd wanted to be buried in Jerusalem, but this was as close as the Cossacks could get. Traitor or hero, the bones are the same. One man can be seen in so many different facets, with each identity resting on a separate surface of a cut gem. Jack Van Crawford sees me as a monster, the perpetrator of a plague, a grinning devil, a heartless seducer. Frederick Chilton sees me as an existential nightmare. Beverly Katz sees the dragon that slaughtered her princess. Margot Verger sees me as a rival. How does Will see me? I see him as Mazeppa saw the forbidden countess at the Polish court as a young man, an exquisite creature caged by others. Byron wrote a lot of rubbish, but happened upon genius from time to time, like a man's toe catching a tree root on a forest path. Will's eyes, blue where the countess's were brown, some of the language strikes true. I change Byron to suit my needs and try not to hear the words in Antony's voice. I'll love half languor and half fire, like saints that at the stake expire, and lift their raptured looks on high as though it were a joy to die. A brow like a midsummer lake, transparent with the sun therein, when waves no murmur dare to make, and heaven beholds his face within. A cheek and lip, but why proceed? I loved him then, I love him still. As such as I am, a love indeed, in fierce extremes, in good and ill. But still we love, even in our rage, and haunted to our very age, with the vain shadow of the past. Mazeppa and the Countess are discovered, of course, and the rest of the poem describes in detail his punishment, being bound to the back of an unbroken horse that is then released into the wild unknown. Byron doesn't say that the beautiful youth is stripped naked and tied face up, but other sources are sure to mention it. And when artists such as Boulanger, Géricault, Delacroix, and Chassereau find inspiration in the tale, they certainly depicted him thus. Their work, or what I've seen of it, reminds me of so many paintings of Saint Sebastian. This is what God's pious subjects do with their talent: paint beautiful young men sensually, their backs arched, submissively subjective to the torture of arrows or a steed's violent galloping over hill and dale. In Géricault's, paying tribute to the lines from Byron's work, the horse has just plunged through a river and is climbing up the bank with the tortured beauty on his back now soaking wet. And these images are not just the private lust of their creators. There's a wide audience that delights in them, but only for their artistic merit, surely. Their reproduction of the human body, the stories behind the suffering, a saint and a tragic hero. Not because the viewer might find it titillating in any way. The world is full of sinners in denial with longings they dare only to express through veils. One look at Guido Reni's version of Saint Sebastian among so many others, and the truth is laid as bare as the boyish saint, showing us miles and miles of milky flesh marred only here and there by an inconvenient arrow or two. So that's pretty much it. Mazeppa is to be punished for his indiscretions with the countess in the poem and allegedly in history, which there's so much more to his life than that, but that's of course what Byron chose to focus on because he's all about that doomed love stuff. His punishment was to be tied naked to the back of a horse that was all cray cray and it was set loose. And then all of these artists like ended up drawing that. And if you image search it, like it is pornographic. As is the Saint Sebastian stuff. I guess what I'm trying to say is that they're both queer icons, and you should all like be thinking about that next time you go to church, especially tomorrow, which is Easter Sunday. Fall into the Saint Sebastian thirst trap. Okay, thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
I love it. All right. Thank you
All
for
right. Yeah, no problem.
lovely.
Back to Pony Keg.
Yeah. All right. So what's the little barrel doing now? Botticelli was really an innovator, of an artist. Interestingly, he was the first to do a few different things. He was the first painter to depict female characters staring directly at the viewer. Prior to his art, women were always depicted from the side or profile view. So, I mean, we could spend like a whole podcast talking about what that means. I don't know. Maybe he was somewhat of a feminist. I'm not sure, but there's a reason why he did that. He was also one of the first to depict non-religious subject matter. So he was living on the edge at the time. He kind of developed, or started to develop this idea of art as pleasure, rather than a way to honor God or to teach people about religion. So it's art for art's sake. That's kind of when this started. And this is kind of blasphemous, or not kind of, a lot. He did a lot of Christian related and religious paintings. He really liked to do like a Madonna and Child. But his work differed from other people who came before him that, that was their subject matter because he added like an emotional depth. He made the subjects relatable. They had warm expressions. It looked like somebody that you would see in person rather than just art. So it's more realistic and more comforting for the viewer as well. So which comes into the sad situation that happened, which I kind of talked about earlier, is this art was considered blasphemous. So some of his work was set aflame at something called the Bonfire of Vanities. This was a big deal. So it was on February 7, 1497, at the behest of an extremist Dominican friar named Savonarola. So this friar believed that the Black Plague was a punishment from God, and the only way to gain God's favor was to get rid of all the things like art and literature, and they even burned, I guess, like cosmetics, like women's cosmetics too. Because they saw that like lipstick and blush and things like that is also demeaning to God. So everything went up. Everything that was
Oh,
determined to be sinful went up.
listen, okay, Savonarola, if you touch what I ordered from Sephora, I will gut you from groin to neck.
Okay, Hannibal.
Sorry, no one's taking my beauty blender, okay?
Yeah, so a bunch of stuff got thrown into this pyre. And at that time, Botticelli actually was kind of a follower. There's the thought that he was actually a follower of this friar and that he kind of turned his back on his art, specifically the art of like the mythologies and things like that, which the Primavera is one of those. So he could even have thrown his own art into this bonfire, which is it's really sad when you think about it. The only works that remain were the ones that were saved by the Medici family. He was under their patronage. So essentially he lived and worked like at the palace. Like they provided for him. That's how he lived, is that a lot of the things that he did, he would do portraits of like the Medici family and things like that. So a lot of those still exist because they were in private ownership, which is great. So thank God for them, or we wouldn't have anything. So Botticelli was also commissioned by the Pope to paint parts of the Sistine Chapel. So I know everybody thinks Sistine Chapel, they say Michelangelo, but a lot of different artists from this time were commissioned to come and work on it. So he has some little spots in there that are really neat to look at along the edges. I know the ceiling proper is mainly Michelangelo, but along the edges, there's some really great work by Botticelli. So he's considered the greatest Florentine workman. There's this fellow by the name of John Ruskin. He was in this movement called the Pre-Raphaelites. which is a 19th century movement of art. It's kind of like they revived kind of this era that Botticelli was in and started like studying his paintings and bringing them back into the public atmosphere. So he had this really interesting quote. It says he was the only painter of Italy who thoroughly felt and understood Dante, and the only one who also understood the thoughts of the heathens and Christians equally, and could in a measure paint both Aphrodite and the Madonna. So that he is, on the whole, the most universal of painters, and take him all in all, the greatest Florentine workman. Which I really think is a really great synopsis of him. He has the mythology, he does the mythology, and he also does like these ultra religious paintings that have this like empathy. That's kind of what it is like when you look at it, like you feel something. You don't feel judged when you look at his Christian paintings. You feel kind of comforted. And I think that's where that's kind of the humanism that started at that point. So unfortunately, his style changed dramatically after this bonfire of the vanities. He stopped painting, the pagan mythology, and he kind of harkened back to the ultra religious themes, which is really sad because I'm sure we would have seen a lot of great things out of him. But, like all artists, I think we have eras. I'm just thinking to myself right now, like I'm a huge Anne Rice fan, huge Anne Rice fan. And she had portions of her life where she hearkened back to her Catholicism, which is her roots, and she disavowed everything to do with the Vampire Chronicles. And she did that several times. So I think people who are on this journey do have these eras of their life where their perspective changes. And I think that's kind of what happened to him. But I'm glad that we got what we got of the mythology. So Botticelli died on May 17, 1510. There is some thought that he was broke as a joke in his later years. There's some thought that he liked to squander money, kind of maybe like a playboy, like to party a little bit, is kind of the sense that I got. One historian said basically he was out of work, he was ill and decrepit, but there's other writings that say that that isn't the truth, that he still was working, and that one of the minor Medici family members was still commissioning him. After his death, which I talked about a little bit ago, he was basically forgotten up until the 19th century, when he was rediscovered by the group of English artists known as the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. And they kind of brought everything, back into the public eye. And now, kind of, that's how we started to appreciate him now.
I think that Taylor Swift also has eras.
Think? Honestly, it's kind of cheesy, but I think every creative person does. I feel like that's just the way it is. I think you just evolve and change, and you can even change back. So,
I think it sucks for people whose earlier eras end up being the more popular. So, like Neil Young, for example. He makes Harvest Moon, and then the record companies just want him to make Harvest Moon over and over and over. And he's like, yo, I'm in a different era now. I'm doing some other stuff. And musicians, especially, like if they have a very, very successful album or a series of albums, and then people just expect them to sort of redo that same sound every single time, and they want to grow and change. Even if what they change into is like what happened with Radiohead. Which is unlistenable at this point. I'm sure it's very cerebral and intelligent. I have no doubt that their musicianship is incredible, but I just want to listen to OK Computer and Amnesiac over and over again, and I just don't care for the rest of it. But I get it. Like, people want to do their own creative stuff, and bless it. Though I'm really glad that Anne Rice was not able to burn all of the Vampire Chronicles because they had already been published at that point. So that's cool. Thank goodness for that.
It made me sad. Like I was there. I was a fan through that whole era of hers, and it was like, wouldn't say it was a dark time, but I feel like I was fairly understanding of what was going on in her life because, like she lost her child when her child was 5 years old to cancer, and I think some of those things were just coming back to her, and she was finding comfort in religion. But I'm glad she came around and started writing some. Vampire Chronicles, which is excellent.
Even though they went off the fucking rails, but you know.
Listen, it's still fire, still fire.
I hadn't read them in forever, and there's a huge chunk in the middle that I just didn't. But then, out of nowhere, I think as a gift, I get Prince Lestat in the Realms of Atlantis, and I started reading it, and I was like, did I accidentally eat like a CBD gummy or something right before I read this? Because it's so fucking
I think you
trippy.
love
Like, no,
stones or something. I don't know.
yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's to the I don't know. You know what? And that's fine. It can be wacky. Like I said, it's basically like late albums of Radiohead. It's like, I appreciate, bless you for being able to make whatever you want. And I'm sure there were some people that were like, yeah, this is just what I wanted. Was bringing Atlantis into this somehow.
Alien.
Yeah, and oh God. So I kept getting bounced by this phrase, the bonfire of the vanities, because I was like, I swear to God, I've heard this before. Like, I know this has to be something that's not just this moment where he burned all of his stuff. By the way, kids, stay away from peer pressure to burn all of your paintings. That's your PSA for the day. So I Googled it while you were talking, and it turns out it was a movie based on a Tom Wolfe book that was written and published in increments in Rolling Stone magazine, and I want to say in the 80s. So it comes out as a movie in 1990 with Tom Hanks and Bruce Willis and Melanie Griffith, who would then one day star with Hugh Dancy in Tempo. Dun dun dun. It's all connected.
It's scary how we find these.
That was me doing my impression of the people who are like, yeah, the lizards own the deep state and the Illuminati is fixing the elections. But anyway, that's totally off topic. But yeah, the Bonfire of the Vanities was actually about like, description: after his mistress runs over a young teen, a Wall Street hotshot sees his life unravel in the spotlight and attracts the interest of a down-and-out reporter. So, Brian De Palma directed it, which,
You might have to watch this.
yeah, I might have to. I mean, it does not have like super great reviews, but I mean, Brian De Palma, he directed Carrie. I mean, that's a classic, fantastic movie. And he also directed a lot of really crappy movies, but that's okay
Yeah,
because
and I
most of
can
them were
see
pretty
why
good.
he chose that as the title. Like, there's a reason why he chose
Yeah.
that as the title. I'd like to see.
Yeah. So if we watch it, then maybe we can solve this mystery and, get back to you guys later as to why it was called that. But yeah,
Put
so
the
maybe
Will
there's
Graham
some.
detective hat on.
Yeah, there we go. Well, plus for then we get to watch movies. Looks like I could spend $3.99 to watch it on Amazon Prime at some point. Okay. I'm back with whiskey. And some further thoughts and observations that came to me while I was going pee. First of all, oh shit, what was it? Damn it. Okay, I remember the second one for sure. So I'm pretty sure it's historically kind of accepted that Leonardo da Vinci was gay. Have you heard that before?
Yes.
Okay. So to me, like if he was hanging out with Botticelli, and they were frenemies. If I know anything about we the queers, it is that we tend to hang around with other queer people and talk shit about them when they're not around, even if we love them. That is the strongest historical evidence that Botticelli was also gay because.
You've heard it here first.
Yeah, he had a best frenemy and they threw shade at each other. So that's, yeah, I feel like we can pretty safely say, marriage nightmare aside, I'm feeling like it's completely possible. But, then again, he was buried at the foot of a woman's tomb. But, I bet there are some guys out there who wish that they could be buried at Judy Garland's tomb, and it doesn't mean that they're straight. So,
Maybe he was a bisexual king. I don't know.
yeah. Bless it, that's, good for him. Good for him. And I really wish I remembered the other thing I was gonna say because I feel like it was good.
Drink some more whiskey and you'll remember.
Okay, hold on. Let me get back in the headspace. Okay, I do remember. I like that you brought up Anne Rice breaking away from her Catholic roots to write about gay vampire outsiders who have a serious problem with religion in general, just due to the nature of their existence. And then how she kind of came back to Catholicism. She wrote, was it those Jesus novels, Christ in Exile, or I don't even
I read
remember.
the first one.
And then, kind of like coming back and forth. And like, I think it's good that we did approach that with some empathy because she felt like she needed the comfort of that religious structure again, even though, I mean, if you want to count up the atrocities done by different groups, the Catholic Church is like pretty high up there with horrible fucking shit that has been visited upon many, many people over the centuries. But religion, we touched on this at the last episode. It's different, interpretations of a source text, which is similar to a fandom. You get your group, and the sense of belonging is very potent. So if you're in a place where you're very vulnerable, the going through the motions of the worship service, being in the church itself and seeing all of the familiar sights and being around all of the familiar people, it is so much more comfortable and easy and reassuring to believe in a higher power than it is to not. It's totally possible that Botticelli was the same way. He's never gets married, maybe queer, we don't know. Obviously, may have had some emotional problems since that just kind of tends to be our thing. I could totally see him like getting sucked into this sort of cult of that douchebag guy. What was his name? Savonarola. He's got a fun name, but he's kind of sounded like a little bitch. But anyway, he that's why people join cults. You do it for social reasons, for acceptance, to fill a void and a hole in you that is gaping and painful. So it sucks that he burned all of his stuff, but I don't blame him because I'm thinking that he was probably at a pretty low point. So it's really the fault of, hold on, find this motherfucker's name again. Where was it? I keep flipping my page. Savonarola, the asshole. Anyway, that's all.
That was a really great reflection on
Yeah.
what you just said.
I don't know if it was great, but it certainly happened out loud from my mouth. So.
I think it just goes in. I think it just shows how potent belief is.
Oh, yeah.
That literally he spent hours and hours, days, weeks, months on these paintings. Like they're beautiful and colorful and lively, and that's like a portion of him. That's an extension of him.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's throwing that into a fire, burning that away from him. He's burning that from his soul, from his core. And that's scary. It's scary that belief in religion can incite that kind of madness in someone.
Yeah, I mean, he was both literally and figuratively like destroying, parts of himself. And especially too, if we, reading all this stuff about how innovative he was and bringing the syncretism of like classical myth with Christianity and possibly, giving women a more prominent space in art and daring to think that art should be something that is just aesthetically pleasing and is meant to make our time here on earth a little bit more comfortable. I mean, that's some pretty righteous shit for that time period. And I can imagine that he was probably quite isolated for thinking that way. But luckily, I mean, say what you will about the Medici, they did us all a solid by saving those paintings and by supporting him throughout his career, especially in the earlier Primavera times. So, don't usually like rich people, but I will give them a pass for that. So, good on you, Medicis.
Do you love the feast is life? Well, guess what? We're not as rich as Count Hannibal Lecter the Eighth. Our incomes are closer to Will Graham's dad fixing boat motors. Head over to Patreon and join our famous Fannibals Club. You'll get access to the show notes and an extra helping of bonus content. Check out how you can support the show at www.patreon.com/thefeastislife. Right now, you can get access to all of our extra content for only $5 a month. We'll be conducting a poll there for what patrons want to see in return for their patronage, and we have loads of ideas for fun surprises for you. Check it out. We need money.
We talked a lot about the Medici in this episode, and you know what they did? They were like the Renaissance Patreon. All right. So if you want to be cool, like the Medici, then you should give us $5. Our featured fic is Aerotrotropia, which is part one of the Ioneo series by Drink Blood Like Wine and Whiskey and Spite on Archive of Our Own. So, first of all, it is a big tag for underage. Will begins the story as like an older teen. He's like 16 or 17. Hannibal's probably like in his 30s, right? So the reason I was thinking a lot about this fic during the preparation for this particular episode is it does feature like an ancient Greek backdrop. The name actually means courtship. The story takes place in ancient Greece. It casts Will and Hannibal in the classic pederastic relationship, right? Where Will's father, as an Athenian nobleman, like gives him to Hannibal to teach and train, and Hannibal gets to keep him for certain kinds of sex. The whole classical world among the upper class, they had the Erastes and the Eromenos, right? And it's kind of the standard for the two pederastic roles. The love of boys or the lover of boys is how that typically gets translated. But in Greek art and writing, the ideal Eromenos was like an unbearded youth, right, with a slim athletic physique. And in this relationship, you know, he's expected to be the passive partner. The Erastes is the older man. He acts as a mentor and a guide to becoming a real man, and he's the more active partner. In this setup, which is historically based on stuff, right? The young teen would go live with this older guy for a while, and he would learn all about like culture and how basically how to be a Greek citizen and a whole bunch of other like fancy nobleman stuff that he needed to learn. And while he was in the situation living there and learning, he also was sort of used in some sex acts that happened. There was this power dynamic of mentor and mentee, of active and passive, and yes, dominant and submissive. And then, of course, because it's me, I had to Google this and then go down another insanely deep rabbit hole. Here's more about the Erastes and the Eromenos, like their relationship. It didn't only happen between humans and the Greek culture, it also happened between like the humans and the gods. So the love between Apollo and Hyacinthus, which we talked about earlier. It was said to have been pretty much the archetype of the perfect Eromenos and Erastes relationship, especially in Sparta. Apollo falls in love with Hyacinthus on account of his youthful beauty, and then invited him to learn archery, music, hunting, and sports. And then Hyacinth ends up getting killed by the discus that Apollo threw, because they were learning about discus throwing as part of his education, because that sounds like a really important part of his education. But you know, track and field is still a thing, so maybe it was. But anyway, that's when our good buddy Zephyrus blew that discus off course and killed him. And then Adonis was Aphrodite's lover, and he also kind of got loved around by some of the other gods. Like Apollo was into him, Heracles was into him, Dionysus. The Homeric Hymn of Aphrodite is it's a poem, and it gives an explicit portrait of the erotic relationship between Ganymede and Zeus. So when I read that description, off I went immediately to the Google machine to find the full text of this poem. And let's just say that Wikipedia and I actually have very different definitions of what we would call explicit. I was hoping for some like old-timey porn, but it really wasn't. It describes the relationship. So Ganymede is this beautiful youth. He gets kidnapped by Zeus from Troy, and he brings him up to Olympus, makes him a god, and he's depicted in these ancient vase paintings as like the ideal of the Eromenos, which is essentially, let's be honest, a young Hugh Dancy. So you can imagine why I was thinking about this fic so much as I'm doing research for this episode, because I was just digging all through these classical antiquity sites and books. And so anyway, back to the fic. So Hannibal, he's a medic, METIC, not like a medic officer. He's a foreigner. He's living in Greece, but he still has all the rights of citizenship. He is portrayed as this battle-scarred warrior. But he's from kind of a more pagan place, a wild place. I don't know if it's ever mentioned. It probably is. It's been a hot second since I've read this. He has a different religion. He seems to come from like a wild and barbaric land. He has very cool, like primal looking tattoos. And Will is the son of a senator. And he's like all mental. He thinks he can solve the world's problems and that violence isn't the answer. He's a future diplomat. He's a peacemaker, right? He does not want to learn about war. He doesn't think he should have to be apprenticed. And he's definitely not into this whole Eromanos-Erastes relationship. And the first chapter is, it is just, chef's kiss. It takes place in a bathhouse, right? Hannibal's there. He's having a spa day. And this mouthy little twink prances in and just starts complaining loudly about being sold off to a quote unquote fat general. And they end up discussing it, right? Because he's like talking about it so loud. Will explains why he thinks he like shouldn't have to go with this random guy. And basically, he's just a rude little gremlin who is naked this whole time. And he's purposely standing around in like various slutty positions, showing off his body. In the end of the exchange, Hannibal thinks of him as, quote, a temptation and a terror. And then only later in the chapter do they meet up again and they figure out that Hannibal is the Erastes that's meant for Will. And it ends with them leaving Athens together, headed for Hannibal's home in the country. So, wow,
It's
talk
so
about a first
fun.
impression. Isn't it so good? There's a book called The Fragility of Goodness. And it was written by this law and ethics professor named Martha Nussbaum. She writes this beautiful section about what the ideal Eromanos was. All right, so just listen to this and see what comes to mind. A beautiful creature without pressing needs of his own, the Eromanos is aware of his attractiveness, but self-absorbed in his relationship with those who desire him. He will smile sweetly at the admiring lover. He will show appreciation for the other's friendship, advice, and assistance. He will allow the lover to greet him by touching affectionately his genitals and his face while he looks himself demurely at the ground. The inner experience of an Eromanos should be characterized, we may imagine, by a feeling of proud self-sufficiency. Though the object of importunate solicitation, he is himself not in need of anything beyond himself. He is unwilling to let himself be explored by the other's needy curiosity, and he has himself little curiosity about the other. He is something like a god or the statue of a god. Okay. Tell me that that is not the perfect description of a classic young Hugh Dancy character, one he might play in one of his earlier movies, like Tempo.
Absolutely.
A role lovingly described by the fandom as the nightmare twink. 100% yes. So it definitely works in that respect. Like this fic would actually work a lot better in more of a Hannibal like extended universe context than a Hannagram one, honestly, but I'll get into that in a sec. So this is one of the few examples of an omniscient third person point of view that I've actually enjoyed. It is also the first slow burn fic that I read, and it really inspired me when I was writing my version of season four of Cuts Unseen. So in my season four in post-fall Cuba, even though they've pretty much already fucked in every way imaginable, Hannibal, like, he wants a reset for their relationship. So in episode one, he actually asks Will if he has permission to court him, and they take it really, really slow as they adjust to this new life together. And honestly, my decision to write it that way was partially based on that like super titillating slow burn of this fic, as well as for like character reasons. And there are like several chapters in season four of Cuts Unseen where they really slowly rebuild their physical relationship. They're like just holding hands and just hugging, then just a little bit of kissing, then like making out, but that's it. It's kind of like a middle school romance speed, at least middle school when I was growing up. Like, I don't know what kids be doing these days, but slow burn until the volcano, right? It explodes. It's a tasty flavor. And to me, like slow burn fics are really best embodied with this drink known around these parts as the Angry Balls, which is mixing Angry Orchard alcoholic apple cider with Fireball whiskey. That's the slow burn fic embodied in a cocktail. And if you join our Patreon, I will give you the recipe. Going back to the fic, it is well researched. You guys know I value very much, and I hold myself to a high standard of historical accuracy to a point, right? If you are a Song of Achilles fan, you will love this. It's got Greek and historical connections. It's got the metaphysical shit that happens like way later in the series. There's tons of angst. Though I will say that there is hope for a happy ending. Dream and I were just talking like the other night about Fellow Travelers, which we were both watching. I do love angst, but my struggle with that show in particular, currently on episode 5, it's like from the get-go, you know that there can't be a happy ending at all. No spoilers, but like I will put my characters through the ringer, okay? I will make them suffer and suffer, but I do believe firmly in happily ever after stories. And so my heart just kind of really can't take anything else. I will say with this fic, I did end up skipping some of the sections in the third book because it was so sad in a Song of Achilles way. So like fair warning there as well, just read the tags. We spent a lot of time discussing the glories of this fic. I do have one major quibble, and we would call it a global, okay? It is significant. It is just out of character. Okay, like full stop. I do not buy Will in this fic as Will from the TV series. Yeah, he loves dogs, and I guess having the empathy might make him a good diplomat and a peacemaker, which actually is a theme I'm playing around with my Omega Will Fest fic that right now. But otherwise, like I really didn't see a lot of effort to like weave in some of his canonical traits. And Hannibal is like a pagan warrior. It's a fun idea, but he lacks the Hannibalish traits that we love him for. You know, we're missing his fussy aesthetics, as Chilton puts it. There is some overlap when we're talking about killing and God, but it didn't sell me in that same respect, especially as I've come to know the characters better. So my suggestion would be like this is a wonderful Hannibal extended universe story with a Mads character. Why not Tristan from King Arthur? Okay, he looks scruffy and like a fighting general guy with braids and tattoos. One eye was another option. Maybe even that dude with the great thighs from Clash of the Titans. Mads has played characters like the general in this fic, the Erastes. You can like easily, delightfully imagine him playing the character in the story if it was made into a movie. And the same with Hugh's character, because this Eromanos is like a fucking nightmare twink, and he's like way closer to Jack Ganser or the Earl of Essex from Elizabeth I, right? They weaponize their sex appeal with an older partner. That would make a way better match than broody old Will Graham, who at his core feels like unlovable and damaged. So if this had a rewrite with Hannibal extended universe characters instead, it would be a perfect fic. It's like beautifully written, it's researched, it's hot, it's slow burning you and then dropping you in a fucking volcano, and it just runs that emotional gamut from joy to despair. You should read it for sure. So yeah, head to the AO3 machine, you will not be disappointed. And now the featured artist.
All right, so this week we're featuring Beatrice. She is on X and Tumblr. It's at Beatrice and then NIUS. Beatricinus? Probably not what it is.
I always pronounced it completely differently in my head, and for some reason there was like a C sound in it. So yeah, just ignore me. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't know either. I'm a patron of hers. She does a lot of Hanagram and Our Flag Means Death art. So her ships are Hanagram and Gentlebeard. She also has fanfic. She has like a lot of not safe for work pieces that have my jaw on the ground and my eyes are literally popping out of my sockets when I see these things.
Yes, the talent, the talent.
Yes. And, you know, if you ever get that tingle when you look at a piece of salacious art or read a particularly smutty scene in a fic, well, that's how I feel every time I see something of this artist's. But also, they have some really lovely original art. Recently, they just posted this really beautiful plus-sized art depiction. And it was really nice to see like my body type depicted in art. And it was cool because the woman like was super hairy. Like she didn't shave her underarms or her legs or anything. And I was like, I love this. And it was like a forest nymph
I
goddess
saw that. Yes,
lady.
yes.
And I thought it was so neat. And I would say like what I think the art stands out because there's such a like eye-catching use of like color. Like the color is just so vibrant and beautiful. They pay such attention to detail in the piece. Just every single one of the artworks that I've seen by this person have like layers and layers. So I'm constantly zooming in to look at every single inch because there's something there, and she wastes no No space. There's no stone unturned. So there's always something really cool and like fascinating and something that like harkens back to the show, even if she's kind of doing an AU. And my favorite thing is Beatrice Hannibal is thick, 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 thick. Just as God intended. Amen.
Even though my mood be dropping, you know that booty be popping.
They have this tattoo shop AU, which I'm obsessed with. There's two works in it already. The first one is semi not safe for work, and the second one is definitely not safe for work. Let's just say the second one takes place on the tattooist chair. Just let your mind wander. But Will is a tattoo artist. He has a shop called This Is My Design, which is super freaking cool. Like I'm already in right when I saw.
Yes.
So he's heavily inked and pierced, and he even has like face tattoos, which can really be off-putting on some people, but they look gorgeous on his face. And let's be real, he would look good in a paper sack.
It
So,
actually it reminds me of Evan Peters' character yet again, bringing it back around
yes,
to American Horror Story season one.
exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and his tattoos are like so meaningful, like show references galore. He's got the flies for fly fishing, he's got a moth, he's got all sorts of really neat tattoos, and that's like definitely one where you zoom in because you want to see everything.
What's tattooed over his butt with the skeleton hands holding his
Skeleton
butt
hands,
cheeks?
yes, cupping his cheeks.
And I can't remember,
Yes.
there's a saying, I can't remember what it is, but you should just buy the Patreon so you can see
Yeah,
it. We don't want to give too much away.
please become a patron. You will literally not regret it because there's always something new and beautiful. And the artist is really receptive to prompts, which is great. So interacting really, frequently the patrons and everything like that. I haven't prompted anything yet, but my only thing is I need more of this AU and I need a fic going along with it. Like I
Ooh.
need like a whole or a comic even. Like
Hey,
I'll settle for a
Beatrice.
comic.
Beatrice, if you're listening, I'm highly available. Just saying.
DB will even be the writer of this.
Wait, I would have to actually get a tattoo for research purposes. I have none. Can you believe that? You're like a tatted person.
Yeah.
So you know what you'll have to, just
I
like
will
with the axe
describe it to
throwing.
you. I will
You just
describe it to
describe it to
you.
me. I live vicariously through your
Yes,
experiences.
live vicariously. So, and the really interesting thing about like this AU is Hannibal has no tattoos at all. Bare skinned, unmarked skin against Will's tattooed skin. And it's just so hot. And I need a cool glass of water and a lobotomy now. So.
I love the I Will with tattoos idea. Like, I don't think canonically he probably ever got one. He might have like a Garfield on his butt cheek or something, but
Not Garfield.
I was just thinking about your cat. No, it's not Garfield. It's definitely a Care Bear. No, not that either. I also concur to everything you've said. It's very, very, very talented, and we are so lucky to have so many talented artists in our fandom. So you should be a patron. And there are different tiers. Tell us about those.
Beatrice has a little tier, which is $1 a month. Which is super cheap. Access to finished works prior to them being published on socials, and you have the ability to prompt the artist, which is awesome for $1, I think. So if you can't shoot for the $5, I would definitely throw her a dollar because it's worth it. So the big tier, like I said, $5 a month, you get access to works that are patron exclusive, which are never published anywhere else. So these are secret little gems that only the patrons get, which is really exciting. And I love it when the emails let me know that there's something new.
All right. So if you enjoyed hearing about that particular artist and you're an artist and you're like, oh, I want to be on the show, we are open to suggestions. And specifically, if you would like to buy an ad spot for only $5 and show us a little bit of your work, we will look at it thirstily and talk about our experiences doing so. So if you enjoyed this episode more than Bedelia Du Maurier loves wine and silky blouses, it'd be really awesome for you to like leave a rating, do some subscriptions, let others know what you think about us, leave us a review. So don't forget to share with your friends, follow us on social media. You can find Dream on Twitter. Do you want to tell us your Twitter handle?
Yeah, I am. Oh crap.
A Dream Within 13.
Yes, A Dream
Yay!
Within
I
13.
know it because I'm always tagging your ass.
Stay tagging each other. They're probably sick of us. Like, why are they always?
Yeah, it was like, why are you having these conversations in public? And then I'm DBMars33. That's all on the Twix. And then we're on Tumblr, DBMars, no 33, Manic Obsessed Fangirl. That's pretty much you in it to a T. And you can also email the show with like thoughts and suggestions, whatever, for your ads, for whatever. DBMars33 at Gmail. We are on TikTok. And I think your TikTok now is A Dream Within 13 as well. And DBMars8. And then our Patreon again is patreon.com/thefeastislife. And you can use any of those platforms to contact us with questions or suggestions of what you'd like us to research or talk about on the show. If you have suggestions for guests we should feature, or if you're interested in sponsoring. Real quick, I just did want to cut in and mention that this is actually only part one of a two-part episode on Botticelli, Primavera, and how it fits into the Hannibal series. We'll be taking a much deeper dive in part two into the mythological figures found in the painting and how they reflect the different characters in our beloved television series. So don't miss part two coming at you next time. Now it's time for the goodbye. You ready?
You're ready.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, if you want to attract your hot cannibal therapist, just be a grouchy gremlin covered in seven kinds of dog hair. The feast is life, cannibal family. Eat
Eat
it
it and
and
live.
live. We did better that time.
Did we?
Yeah, I think we did.